Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The great American Southwest is a realm of stunning, even otherworldly beauty. Mountains and mesas and deserts that bloom. But it is hot and dry. And with climate change, it's getting hotter and drier. It's burning and thirsting. Two big new books say it won't survive as we've come to know it. This hour on Point, heat, fire, dust, and thirst roll into the great American Southwest. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the fires, the temperatures, the dust storms, the drought? Do our cities there adapt, shrink, die? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is William DeBise, environmentalist and author of the new book, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. He says the region could be on the verge of the greatest water crisis in the history of civilization. William DeBise, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
Very glad to be here, Tom.
You say that the so-called civilization of the Southwest, and I got a lot of family there, and I love the Southwest, you say it will not survive the present century. Why? What's going on, Bill?
Well, there's a host of changes that are in store for the Southwest, and some are already operating. You know, the climate change models that we have proved to be pretty reliable, except in one major respect, and that is that the changes occurring out here in the world are actually occurring faster than predicted. The primary prediction for the Southwest has been that temperatures would increase over this century by about 4 degrees centigrade. That's 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Looks like we're going to get more increase than that.
So,
and the big thing is that the hotter it is, the less water there is, even if precipitation stays steady. And that's because when it's warmer, there's more evaporation.
Take us to the challenge, Bill. I mean, look at the Southwest already. And how many times I've enjoyed such good times there with family and friends. Phoenix, right at the heart of things. But of course, it's a big city in a desert. It's already kind of, you would say, well, how can that be? But there it is. People have figured it out for a long time. Why is it that you see in this century it potentially becomes untenable? You know, what do you say to those who say, look, we've engineered this and we've worked this decade after decade and grown this in a place where nobody thought it could be done, but we've done it?
Well, that's right. One of the great achievements of American society in the 20th century was creating a sense of abundance in the Southwest. The water projects, Hoover Dam, Glen Canyon Dam, the energy projects, the coal generation complexes and so forth, they made possible a big and booming and abundant civilization in the Southwest. Trouble is, as we grow into that abundance, we convert abundance to scarcity. And then if the climate changes, as it is doing, the resources on which all that business depends, especially the water, grows shorter. And what do you do? We're going to have to shrink it back over the next century. It's going to be a difficult project.
Shrink it back like what? I mean, we know what Phoenix is now. It's a big city, for a long time a booming city. It's in a bust right now, and you've got developments laid out going nowhere and others practically being abandoned. But that seems primarily at this point, correct me if I'm wrong, an economic issue. The whole housing market is gone bust. But if it would shrink back, how far, how radically? Would it look like Phoenix now, just smaller or something else, Bill?
Well, my crystal ball isn't clear enough to tell you how much. But as the scientists would say, the thing to look for is the sign of the change. Is it positive or negative? And there are five big factors out there that point to a negative trend over the long haul, not tomorrow, not the day after, but over the long haul in the Southwest. And water is the key factor. Do we have enough water to sustain what we have now? And how we're going to deal with diminishing supplies of water as climate change and potentially other factors take hold.
Well, you've got this, if we look beyond Phoenix to the whole region, you've got this amazing image, and more than an image, a fact. You've got Lake Mead, where so much water is so critically trapped from the Colorado River. You describe how the Southern Nevada Water Authority, this is basically the water for Vegas, Las Vegas, I guess.
That's right.
Is tunneling under the lake to install what you call the equivalent of a bathtub drain at close to its lowest point, spending more than $800 million to, if and when it comes to it, drain the dregs, the last drops of Lake Mead for Las Vegas.
That's exactly right. Patricia Mulroy, the very impressive, the redoubtable head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, told me that she absolutely expects that Las Vegas will lose its primary intake of water from Lake Mead as Lake Mead shrinks back from current levels. And she's got to have this drain.
You mean it loses primary intake because the water level will be below the intake?
That's exactly right, yes.
It's already gone down a lot. It's come back up in the last couple of years. What's to say it can't just fill up again?
Well, it's come back really just in this past year because of very heavy snows and runoff in the far northern Rockies, Wyoming and Utah primarily, Colorado some. But the big game in the Southwest, the big question is, will Lake Mead survive? And there's been extensive studies by more than one research group looking at Lake Mead and its water budget, and the verdict that they come to after a lot of going back and forth and some considerable disagreements and debates is that after about 2026, which is like the day after tomorrow in terms of developing water infrastructure, after 2026, the risk of failure of Lake Mead just skyrockets. And in using that word, I'm quoting one of the people involved in those studies, just skyrockets.
What happens
now,
to
failure? Failure, what that means is that the level of the lake has dropped lower than any of the outlets from the dam that holds the lake. So you can't get the water out.
What happens in that case? You name the cities, but what happens to population centers in the Southwest if Lake Mead goes that low?
Well, it spells big, big trouble for Central Arizona, which is heavily dependent on the Central Arizona Project, which derives its water from the Colorado, from water coming out of Lake Mead. It spells big trouble for Los Angeles and San Diego as well. They have other water sources, but here's the problem. If the environment is changing in a way that causes Lake Mead to fail, it probably means, too, that there's not much water resource in the Sierra Nevadas of California, which is the other main supply for Los Angeles and San Diego.
You say deserts are called deserts for a reason, because historically they end up deserted. And this has happened before in Arizona, the Pueblo, the Anasazi, others hit by drought and gone. Are we somehow technologically superior enough that we can hang in when others ultimately gave up and drifted off?
Well, that's really the big question is to what extent is our technology going to save us from the kinds of problems that the medieval people of the Southwest battled against and at times overcame, but eventually had to surrender to. And looking at the archaeological record is really fascinating because different medieval civilizations failed or abandoned their land for different reasons. And there are nuggets of lessons in the story of each of those groups.
The things that afflicted them in those times are the same ones that may or will, as you describe it, afflict Americans in this region. I mean, you've talked about water and thirst, but your sort of horrible quartet here is heat, fire, dust, and thirst. Remind us what's going on heat-wise and where that's headed.
Well, it's just, as I say, we're about 1 degree centigrade into this rise of now we think 4 to 6 degrees over the course of the century, and things are really getting hotter. And because of increased evaporation, that means things are getting drier too, even if precipitation stays steady. But you wouldn't want to bet your house on that, because there are lots of indications that precipitation is going to decline.
Fire and dust. So, we've seen so many images of wildfires over huge areas this year.
That's right. And fire is really not the only thing that is changing the ecologies of the forests of the Southwest. One of the features of climate change is that it encourages the growth of insects. And actually, as big as the impacts of fire have been, the impacts of insects on the forests, budworms and bark beetles, has been even greater.
You mean once they're weakened by fire, the insects move in? Is that it?
Well, the trees are weakened by drought primarily, but with warmer temperatures, it means that not as many insects die during the hard freezes of the winter. Spring starts earlier, so the insects become active earlier. They have more reproductive cycles during a longer growing season, and so their numbers build exponentially, and sometimes to the point that they can overcome the defenses of even very healthy trees.
And then we've seen the giant dust storms in the Southwest just in this last year, a couple of them, I think, that just looked like something out of a special effects studio. You couldn't believe they were for real, these giant domes moving in.
That's right. They recall the dirty 30s, the Dust Bowl years. And they have a feedback effect on things, too, because all this airborne dust landing on the mountains, on the snowpacks in the mountains, means that those snows are going to warm up and melt earlier than they would otherwise, and that exacerbates the water problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great American Southwest up against climate change and whether the Southwest, as we've built it, can survive, looking at predictions of a future, some of it happening right now, of dust and fire and heat and thirst. Here's the sound, this was Texas in April of last year. Reuters reporting on wildfires burning over tens of thousands of acres of land in West Texas.
The flames are moving eastwards, fueled by bone-dry weather conditions and strong winds. The state is experiencing the worst drought in nearly a century.
Records all over the place last year for heat, for fire, you name it. In June, the so-called Wallow Fire became the largest in Arizona's recorded history, burned more than 840 square miles in Arizona, neighboring New Mexico, displaced thousands. Here's firefighter Bill Bishop in June describing the giant blaze to KRQE Television in Albuquerque.
This is not a fire that people can attack directly. Everybody's been using an indirect strategy, trying to make use of natural barriers, lakes, rivers, roads, dozer lines, trying to just get out in front of this fire and stop it. And it's been very challenging.
There's a long history of dealing with desert and drought and dry and heat in the Great Southwest. Can it, will it still be done in the face of climate change that appears to be going on? We've been talking with William DeBuys, joining us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. His big new book is A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. We'll hear in a moment from a Phoenix developer, attorney, and environmental observer who says, hey, we've done it and we can continue to do it. Andrew Ross is not so sure. He's a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University, author of the new book, Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City. Joins us now from New York. Professor Ross, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. By least sustainable city, I guess you mean Phoenix, Arizona, right in the heart of this region. That's a big claim. You know, there's a lot of cities that seem to be on the edge of trouble these days, whether it's, you know, ocean or floodplain, you name it. Why do you make that claim for that tough claim for Phoenix?
Well, it's certainly the epicenter of climate change in the region. And climatologists have certainly estimated that central Arizona will dry out and heat up faster than any other region in the northern hemisphere. So certainly it is very environmentally challenged, and Bill is focused on a lot of the physical factors that contribute to this. My book is about the urban region, the metro region of Phoenix, and it's sort of based on interviews with a couple of hundred movers and shakers in the region, about the prospects for the sustainability of the region over the next few decades. And I found that it's social and political factors that are as important as the physical factors in determining how a city becomes sustainable over the long term. And the social and political factors may even be more important than the physical ones.
I want to look at those. I want to come to those. Give us a framework for considering them, Andrew Ross. When you look at Phoenix, in the heart of this great Southwest, in a city I think is a terrific city, but yet you can see, you know, where it is and the challenges it faces. What's, in your view, what's the sort of best case and worst case scenario for, let's take Phoenix, in this century?
Well, I'm not in the prediction business myself. I mean,
everybody says prediction business, but I get tired of that. You guys look at all the trends that are converging here. You must be looking forward. Isn't that the point of what you're doing here?
To some degree, although I'm relying on the estimates of people on the ground.
Those would be scientists and immediate observers. So give us your best sense.
Okay. Well, I think the physical challenges are pretty obvious. They always have been in the case of a metropolis like Phoenix. It's always been a tenuous proposition, and it's only been made possible by centuries of lavish federal investment in not just the water infrastructure, but also the land development infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And this is something that a lot of libertarians, politically speaking, in the West are inclined to be in denial about. You know, behind every rugged individual is usually a government agency, as the state's historian once said. But here's how the social and political factors shake down. Every city, it seems, now has a sustainability plan, and that's a great thing, because cities are in the front line of combating or averting climate change. Mm-hmm. But how they shape that plan could make things worse, because it could exacerbate the great inequalities that exist, that every city hosts an enormous number of social inequalities. And so one of the outcomes, and you can already see it, you can see the footprint of it in mm-hmm. Phoenix and many other cities, is that you have pockets of green, pockets of population living the green American dream in affluent upland parts of the town, mm-hmm. while across the tracks, low-income populations are you know, struggling to breathe clean air and drink fresh water. And that's a huge challenge. And as I say, it's a social and political challenge as much as a physical one. You can also see it, however, in the international debate about climate emissions. Which are the countries, which are the populations that might get sacrificed, and which are the ones that are going to get preserved?
Bill de Baes, just that piece to Bill de Baes for a second. Bill, Andrew Ross writes about what he calls the future of maybe eco-apartheid, where some are doing all right and others are really in trouble. Your picture seems to be more the possibility of a whole population just drifting away, Bill.
Well, you know, I don't think whole populations are gonna go away. They're gonna be stickers. They're gonna be people who stay behind, who tough it out, and so forth. But I agree completely with Andrew Ross that mm-hmm. As our communities try to deal with these really terrific challenges, the ones that do it most successfully will be the ones that are the most politically unified, that have the strongest consensus about what to do. And communities that have sort of an equality of condition among their citizens have the best shot at achieving that kind of consensus.
Andrew Ross, you say that equality of condition has already slipped away, if it was ever there, to a very large degree, and could get worse. When you talk with folks in Phoenix, movers and shakers, and we're going to talk to one in just a moment here, but you've talked with a lot. You know, you're reluctant on scenarios, but I mean, that helps us think about the future. What do they say? What do people in the region think of best and worst case scenarios? Let's say for the city you've paid so much attention to, Andrew.
One of the things that surprised me in my research and interviews was how very few people in Phoenix had a future vision of the city in a condition of eco-collapse. In fact, not that many people saw drastic shrinkage of the population. Now, in part, that's probably Western boosterism, which is a very famous mentality. And in part, possibly defensiveness. But then again, there's also the allegory that the city sits upon, which is that one of those medieval civilizations that Bill mentioned, the Hohokam, it disappeared in the mid-15th century. This is a civilization that did not respond all that well, ultimately and sociologically speaking, to tightening resources. So if you live in a city that already sits atop an allegory of eco-collapse, perhaps it's a little more difficult to imagine a similar scenario for your own town. If you had to force me to make a prediction, however, I would say that the likely scenario is one in which you have enclaves of very affluent and well-resourced populations that manage to hoard their resources and as I say, live quite comfortably and only in condition that other parts of the population are going to get sacrificed or will leave.
That's interesting. Bill DeBise, I forget if it's you or Andrew, who says, maybe, but on the other hand, it may be even hotter and drier. Across the border in the Sonoran and Mexico, you could see new populations coming north to try and escape climate change effects just south of the border. What about that, Bill?
Yes, that's right. I think the changing climate is going to put people in motion all over the continent. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to make specific predictions about this place or that place. I think we're going to see people from the south coming north as they are now, but perhaps with even greater desperation, greater impetus in the future as things continue to degrade. And so who knows what Phoenix will be like 30, 40, 50 years from now and how one population moving might partly replace another. But the one thing for certain, in my view, is that the strains of climate change are going to generate sort of tectonic shifts along all the fault lines existing in society. And the kinds of economic gradients that Andrew Ross is talking about, the inequalities, are exactly those kinds of fault lines.
Let's let our listeners in here. Let's go to Huntsville, Arizona, and Jim. Jim, thank you very much for calling from Arizona. You're on the air. Hello, Jim. We'll try and get Jim with his ear back to the phone. Let's get another here. Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I grew up in Arizona, so I guess I'm one of those people that moved farther north, but not for climate change reasons. But when I grew up in Tucson and Phoenix, and when I was studying in school there, I remember once I looked at a picture of the Saguaro National Forest, which the saguaros are the really big cactuses.
Sure.
And the water, if you looked at that forest 100 years ago when they first started taking photographs, the water table, just because of the way we developed Phoenix and Tucson, had sunk so drastically that it went from looking like literally a forest of cactuses to what is so sparse. And it's because these big cactuses have these root systems and they couldn't reach the water anymore. And so now we have such an unsustainable development. Yes, it was great for a certain amount of time, but millions and millions of gallons of water for golf courses. How is that when we have this climate change? Like here in Buffalo, we've had 2 inches of snow tops. That's like unheard of by the first of the year. So, but in a place like Arizona where it shows up so much more quickly, you have like the perfect storm for actually seeing how drastic climate change is. So, you know, as a overall mankind group, we have to pay attention to this and actually notice, yes, this is going on.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Buffalo gets less snow but sits on a big lake. Phoenix gets more heat, and there's no big lake right there. Let me get one more right here. Kevin in Amherst, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a hydrologist and did a lot of work in the Southwest in the 70s and the 80s as a petroleum geologist. I saw back then with the water usage that the area was unsustainable. And I thought it was amazing that you would ask about technological fixes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the technological fixes that got us into this in the first place. You can't create water. Even putting in a a nuclear power plant in California that runs a desalination plant and pipes it over the mountains isn't going to produce more than 1% of the needs for the area. You have to rely on Mother Nature. And, you know, if the water isn't there, it's not going to take decades for people to leave. It's going to take just years. All you need is 2 or 3 years of serious drought for the reservoirs to dry up and, you know, the Colorado to drop. And you're not going to have enough water in the area to sustain the population that you have.
And never mind technology. You say that's kind of built the thing that may not be sustainable. Well, look at that, Kevin. I appreciate your hydrologist's view. And let me get one more. Jim, back in Arizona, Huntsville. Jim, thanks. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to comment on the fact that everybody's pretty quick to chalk all this up to global warming or climate change or whatever they're calling it these days. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you ask my granddad, he'll tell you, you know, we come from a long line of cattle farmers, and he'll tell you, you know, you got your green years, you got your dry years, and that's just the way Mother Nature made it.
So you're not buying that it's climate change, but if you're a cattle farmer, you must be paying close attention to what's going on. Do you see a change in, I don't know, what's available to your cattle, to the temperature, to the energy you have to put into keeping them cool in the hottest part of the summer? Do you see things changing, Jim?
Yes. And I mean, changing, yes, changing permanently, I don't know. I have lost some cattle this year. I talked to my dad about it, and he said my granddad as well, he lost cattle when he farmed. And it's, you know, people just need to learn to live with what they have. You know, we're talking before about how it'll just take a couple of years for everyone to up and leave if the Colorado goes down. Well, I think that has to do more with the problem of the people living around it than it does with the actual climate.
Jim, I wish you very good luck with your cattle there in Arizona, and I appreciate your call. Bill DeBise, you know, how about it? You've got your green years, you've got your dry years. Here's a listener online says, civilizations have survived climate change for 2,000 years anyway. Why would today be any different than much more primitive civilizations, Bill?
Well, the point is well made. You know, in a way, Arizona and the Southwest has plenty of water as long as the cities are in the right places. If you look at where our cities are right now, they're not where the water is. And if you look in the deeper past of the Southwest, now we have tree ring reconstructions of the flow of the Colorado River mm-hmm. going back to the 8th century. Mm-hmm. And what they show is that the average yield of the river through that long, long period is much less than what we assumed when we began divvying it all up, and much less than we assume than the assumptions underlying our present use. So again, yeah, learn to live with what you have. But right now, we're living way above that level.
And what about our cattleman Jim in Arizona who says, look, from his granddad on down, you know, their presumption is you've got green years and you've got dry years. Tough it out. It'll get better.
One of the scariest things in the Southwest is that the long-term record, the archaeological, the paleo water record, shows us that the South characteristic of the Southwest are something called mega droughts. These are droughts that last more than a decade, several decades long. It was mega droughts that brought down the Chaco Canyon civilization, mega droughts that helped bring down the Mesa Verdean civilization. In the historic period, the period during which we Americans have been developing the Southwest, we haven't yet experienced a mega drought, but they're out there. They're coming back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Great American Southwest up against climate change and whether the Southwest, as we've built it, can survive. William DeBise is with us. His new book is A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. Andrew Ross is with us. His book is Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City, by which he means Phoenix. Put together, their books are getting a lot of attention again to a region where for years people have said it can't survive, and yet it has. But what about now? In this century. Here's a little bit from, this was November 2009. Then Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon released this public service ad touting his city's, Phoenix's, green goals.
Hi, I'm Mayor Phil Gordon of the city of Phoenix. Like all smart cities, we're working hard to obtain jobs, sustainable companies, and new energy. And that's why my friends at Repower Arizona and I are working hard every day to build a green Phoenix.
Good for them. Can they do it in this century? Bill DeBise is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Andrew Ross in New York. And right now, from Phoenix, Arizona, we're joined by Grady Gamage, Jr. He's an attorney who represents real estate developers in Phoenix, also a developer, also pays a lot of attention to water and the environment, author of a recent Morrison Institute report called Watering the Sun Corridor. Think Phoenix. Grady Gamage, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So, I've read your critique of Andrew Ross's book here. You're a smart guy. You also have a lot to do with development, duly noted. What do you think about the predictions of kind of up against maybe the impossible in Phoenix in this century?
Yeah, I think the alarmist tone of both Andrew's book and Bill DeBye's book is a little hyperbolic and out of control. I think both are very good books, by the way, and I've been recommending them to people in Phoenix to read them. I particularly like Andrew's point that in a place of geographic challenge, you have to have functional politics to deal with it. And that, I think, is probably the biggest challenge Phoenix has, is we have a lot of people here who think we should dismantle government. Well, we couldn't exist here without government. But as to the pure resource challenge, I think the situation is much less bleak than it has sounded so far on your program, because I've been listening. A place like Phoenix is built on the assumption of a highly variable water supply. Climate change is going to increase the amplitude of that variability, but the mere fact that we have built a system based on variability gives us resilience that a lot of other places don't have. Atlanta, for example, was down to something like a 30-day of water supply and storage.
Last year, yeah.
Years ago.
Mm-hmm, yep.
If we have less than 4 years' worth of water in storage, we get worried about it, and we start making adjustments. And bear in mind, too, that urban Arizona, that is the Sun Corridor, which my report is about, mm-hmm. half of the water in the Sun Corridor is still going to agriculture. Now, that's not a one-to-one relationship. You can't turn all that water into urban water,
mm-hmm.
but you can, and we have, moved that water to urban uses over time. So the conclusion of my report is, even if you factor in a significant hit from climate change. I used 15%. The Bureau of Reclamation's current number for the Colorado is 9%.
Okay.
Decrease in supply. Even if you factor that in, we can probably support 8 to 9 million people in the Sun Corridor. We're at about 5 right now.
So you're saying Phoenix and the Sun Corridor can afford...
augmenting supply. We could probably get to that number.
I'm sorry, but you could support millions more people, you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, but let me say this. I think Bill DeBise said we may have to shrink Phoenix. I don't think we have to shrink Phoenix, but we're going to have to make tougher choices as we go forward. Do we preserve any remnant of agriculture in central Arizona? Do we continue to have a lifestyle where people have individual swimming pools? Do we continue to have a lifestyle where we significantly alter the landscape? More than half of the water that's used in the city of Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
I'm putting agriculture to one side,
right.
More than half of that water is used for landscaping. It's used outside of the home. Well, we could change that, and in fact, we have been changing that. In the last decade, we've reduced the per capita consumption in Phoenix by nearly 20%. So it's not like we're just blithely ignoring this stuff and, you know, spraying water randomly around. We are thinking about these issues and trying to react to them, and we have a pretty good history of that. You know, it's easy, I think, Andrew did this and did this well, to make the point that Phoenix, after all, is named after a bird that immolates itself periodically in its own field. Funeral pyre, and therefore it's unsustainable. On the other hand, you have to remember that means there's been a civilization here for about 1,500 years.
Well, there have been civilizations, right? I mean, there have been...
I can say that.
But Arizona has had a number of civilizations, and some of them have gone away under the pressure of these things. Let me ask you, if I may, just to be really clear, you're a developer, and you look at water and all the rest. You spoke of climate change. Do you agree with the assessments that say climate change is underway, just to be very clear about that?
Yes, I do. I do, and I think it's human-caused, and I think it's a serious challenge, and I think we all need to think about it and react to it and figure out how to deal with it, because we're not going to stop it at this point. I think it is too late to stop it. We can mitigate it, and we can react to it.
Okay, in that case, when you look at just the numbers, let's just take the last year. Now, I know our cattleman Jim from Arizona says, look, there's got green times and dry times, but you've got record temperatures, you've got record drought, you've got record wildfires all over the Southwest. When you say that Bill DeVries and Andrew Ross work may in some respects be hyperbolic or out of control, but really, when you look at those numbers, I mean, those are facts, and they're pretty terrible.
Let's take those one at a time. The wildfire problem is primarily a fault of man. It is the result of our having suppressed wildfire for too long and allowed the forest to grow into an unhealthy and unnatural condition. Wildfire is a natural phenomenon in the Southwest. We should have been letting wildfires burn for the last 100 years. We didn't, and we created an unhealthy forest. And that's primarily why we have such out-of-control wildfires. You know, as to the temperatures, yes, we are having record temperatures, and that concerns me. I think we bump up against a point at which people won't want to live here. Most of those record temperatures are the result of a localized phenomenon called the heat island, which is the result of the city not cooling off the way it used to at night. When you take the heat island effect and add to it the predicted climate change incidents, mm-hmm. it's going to get real hot, and that is a problem that we have to try to face over the next 40 or 50 years. The current drought we're in is not really a record drought. I think Bill's point about mega droughts is the much more serious point. We are in a serious drought now, but we are within the kind of drought that we have built systems to manage our way through. And in fact, we've been doing that better than any other city in the Southwest.
Okay, Grady Gamage, please stand by there in Phoenix for a moment. Bill DeVries, I want to bring a couple of these to you. And first of all, the notion asserted by Grady here that Phoenix is a city built on the assumption of highly variable water supplies. So, you know, they're ready for this. Water will be up or down, but Phoenix can deal with it. In fact, they could have millions more people in the urban corridor. Bill DeVries, what do you say?
Well, I have enormous respect for Grady and the work that he's done in Central Arizona, and would delight in an opportunity for a really long conversation with him on these matters. The key thing for Central Arizona is whether Lake Mead is going to continue to function properly. If they lose Lake Mead, if the Central Arizona project goes dry, then all kinds of consequences ensue. And you can't, in a sense, conserve your way out of this kind of problem. Yes, Arizona has lots of stored underground water as reserves, but if Lake Mead goes down because the Colorado dries up, it's likely that the Salt River will also have declined, and Salt River is another big source mm-hmm. of water for Central Arizona. Mm-hmm. So then you're in a fix. You've got to transfer water from agriculture. You've got to get people to conserve more. Here's the conundrum of conservation. You get people to give up their swimming pools. You get them to use low-flow toilets. You get them to use less water, and Phoenix has been doing this very well. Where does that saved water go? Well, under the paradigm we operate mm-hmm. with today, that saved water goes to more development. And so then you have more strip malls down the road,
right.
more high-density or low-density subdivisions, more people conserving. And what you have then is a situation where the water everybody is using is essential. You don't have waste in the system. Waste is your friend when the drought comes because then you can conserve.
Yeah.
But if everybody is using only what they absolutely need, you have this phenomenon called hardened demand, and then you can't shrink down anymore without real suffering.
Bill, let me ask you something. Here's Grady. You say you respect his work, and here he is. He's a developer and represents more of them, but he says he buys climate change. He buys the need to change, and yet he looks at your work and the work of Andrew Ross with us here and says hyperbolic, out of control. Now, You must feel this sort of social cultural dynamics of trying to grapple with climate change. What are you thinking, Bill, when you hear your work described that way?
Well, you know, I don't relish being in the position of a Jeremiah, and I doubt Dr. Ross does either. And you can be sure that neither of our books is going to be particularly popular with the Chamber of Commerce in Greater Phoenix. The whole economy there is based on growth. And no American city has really yet found a way to put a cap on growth and to achieve some kind of steady state economy. And that, at the core, is what makes all these places potentially unsustainable.
Grady Gamage, Andrew Ross, I want to bring those thoughts to you. A lot of listeners here. Let me bring a couple in first. Bill in Cookeville, Tennessee. Bill, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Always a great show.
Thank you.
I was a flying cadet in Phoenix, outside of Phoenix, in 1941. It was green all around Phoenix. Phoenix was a small town.
Mm-hmm.
It still had shaded sidewalks. It looked like an all-Western town.
Wow.
It was a great farming area. I think it was a fruit growing area.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved over to Scottsdale. Scottsdale was out in the desert, a village crossroads. And I was waved at by farmers on tractors as I made my final landing on an airfield there.
Yeah.
My comment is, how much did the destruction of all that green land that was supported by the Salt River contributed to the destruction? I know it's so overbuilt. You know, the tallest building when I was there was about 5 stories high, you know.
Yeah.
This steel absorbs the heat all day long, and of course it doesn't lose it, as someone said. You know, but I think it was the destruction, filling the land all the way between Phoenix and Scottsdale. You can't tell where one ends and the other begins. How much did the destruction of all that green farmland contribute to the destruction, and how could
we that's interesting, Bill. Let us look at that. I mean, on the other hand, with all that development, you've, as Grady and others were saying, you've got a lot of green in individual people's yards. For all the conservation efforts there and going with desert landscaping and all the rest, you can still find plenty. Andrew Ross, what about the net volume of green in this valley with all the development since our caller Bill was flying as a cadet there in the early 40s?
Well, some people would say that the best indication of the greening of Phoenix would be actually the browning of Phoenix, that people would be using less water to sustain plant life that, for the most part, is a transplantation from the Midwest. But I think what we're talking about here, and what the person who called in evoked in the nostalgia for this earlier period, is the issue of growth. And much as I respect, again, Grady's comments and the work that he's done in Phoenix, he does see the issue through the lens of growth. And his comments on the show today do reflect that. This has been the single driver of the economy in central Arizona for the past few decades. It's a single industry town, like Detroit in many respects.
Develop, expand.
Land development and people building houses for people who are building houses. This is the conundrum. And that industry fell off a cliff a few years ago. And economically speaking, there really is no plan B right now. There's no evidence that the growth machine will start up again on the urban fringe, and certainly nothing like the way it was driving the economy in the last couple of decades or so. So the issue of economic sustainability is a very big one, too. If people are going to be living in that region, surviving under these extreme resource conditions, how are they going to earn a livelihood?
Bill DeBise, we've got a call, a listener in Indiana who asks if we could divert other rivers to the southwest. I mean, people have even talked about the Mississippi waters being diverted to the southwest. Is there some mega project that would water it again, Bill?
Well, in fact, if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, it was the belief that the Colorado River and the resources of the southwest would be augmented by water from other watersheds that underlay many of the threshold decisions leading to the kind of growth we're talking about today. The trouble is those grandiose plans are enormously costly in terms of energy consumption and environmental damage. And today, I can't imagine the citizens of any other watershed gladly relinquishing some major portion of their resources so that they can be diverted and pumped to the southwest at the cost of several nuclear reactors to provide the energy.
Grady Gamage.
So the dream of augmentation has, for the most part, gone away.
Grady, in brief, look, I don't know, 30, 50 years out, what do you see in Phoenix?
Well, let me try to answer briefly a couple of the things that were said there.
Just got a minute, Grady, so you know.
We're not going to move up water from elsewhere here, but I think in the long term, we will wind up desalting water on the Pacific Rim for California. Los Angeles is closer to the hitting the wall than Phoenix is in terms of its water supplies,
great,
as is San Diego. Mm-hmm. And that's going to precipitate that as an ultimate solution, and Phoenix will keep using Colorado River water. What will happen here over the long term, I think, is we will come to grips with whether or not we should preserve any agriculture. I hope we will, because it gives us management flexibility in the future. And the lifestyle will begin to change. We'll begin to live at higher densities. We'll begin to use public transportation more, reducing our carbon footprint. We'll begin to change the way in which we think about the use of water and probably have less private swimming pool and fewer golf courses, and we'll be fine.
Are people still going to want to move to Phoenix if you take away the pools and the, you know, the...
Well, that's a good question. To some extent, what we're discussing here is a self-limiting factor. As we begin to change the lifestyle, it may become less attractive for people to want to move here. And Andrew's point is right. We are kind of a one-industry town, but growth is a different kind of industry than building automobiles. It can't go to Japan or Korea, and it brings with it a whole series of people moving here that bring different kinds of businesses. So the truth is our economy is relatively diversified, even though we are largely dependent on cheap land and sunshine.
As long as there's something to drink, nip and tuck or full overhaul or even something like desert, well, we'll see. Stakes are huge. Bill DeBye, Andrew Ross, Grady Gammage, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.